Chapter number 51, Prophets. Page number 629. Lesson number 1, Gross Profit and Net Profit. In ordinary language, profit is the surplus of income over expenses of production according to a businessman. It is the amount left with him after he has made payments for all factored services used by him in the process of production. But he may not have been careful in calculating all such expenses of production in the economic sense. Therefore, economists regard businessmen's profit as gross profit as distinct from pure or net profit because it includes the following constituents. 1. Rent on land. The businessman may have used his own land for erecting the factory so that he may be saved of the botheration of paying rent to some other landlord. This rent is included in his profit. This is implicit or imputed rent which is not a part of his profit. Had he hired land from some other person, he would have paid its rent. In calculating the net profit, implicit rent should be deducted from gross profit. 2. Interest on capital. Similarly, he may have used his own capital in his business in order to avoid the inconvenience of borrowing from some other person. This implicit interest is again included in his gross profit. If he had borrowed the same amount of capital for investment in his business, he would have paid interest on it. This interest should therefore be subtracted from his gross profit to arrive at net profit. 3. Wages of management. The businessman may have been busy in organizing, coordinating, and managing the entire business himself. But he may have been contented with income received after meeting all expenses of production. If he had not performed the work of management himself, he would have employed a manager to whom he would have paid wages. Thus, his gross profit included implicit wages which are required to be deducted for calculating net profit. In all joint stock companies, profits are received by shareholders, but the managers and managing directors are all salaried persons whose salaries are included in the expenses of the firms. 4. Depreciation charges. During the process of production, machinery and plants depreciate and become obsolete. Expenses incurred on their repairs and replacements are a part of the cost of production. Hence, they should be excluded from gross profit for the purpose of calculating net profit. Page number 630. 5. Insurance charges. Every firm gets itself insured against fire, accidents and losses of other kinds for which it pays large premiums annually to insurance companies. They are a charge on the revenue of concern and therefore do not form part of the gross profit. All these elements are present in gross profit even in the long run as they are relatively stable. Frequent and violent changes occurring in gross profit are due to the presence of net profit within the former. It is therefore net profit which may be positive or negative. 6. Net profit. Net, true, economic or pure profit is the residue left to the entrepreneur after deducting all the items enumerated above from gross profit. Net profit, however, includes the following elements within it. A. Reward for uncertainty bearing. Pure profit which an entrepreneur receives is the reward of bearing uninsurable risks and uncertainties. Uncertainty bearing is one of the main functions of an entrepreneur in the present capitalist system which leads to profit. B. Reward for coordination. The present system of production is one of coordinating the right quantity of factors in the right proportions. An entrepreneur who combines them in the right way is able to produce large quantities of the product with a minimum of cost and thus earns the largest amount of profit. C. Rent of ability. Net profit accruing to the businessman also includes the rent of his ability. An entrepreneur with a superior business acumen is able to earn a larger profit than the others. D. Reward of innovation. An entrepreneur who innovates by bringing out a new product or technique of production earns higher profit than others. E. Monopoly gains. The modern market system is characterized by the existence of imperfect markets. Some of the shrewd entrepreneurs are able to push up their sales by making their products appear distinct and superior to others. In this process, they also succeed in raising the prices of their products. Thus, their profits swell when they create semi-monopolist conditions for themselves. F. Windfalls. Pure profit earned by an entrepreneur may also include fortuitous or chance gain. The demand for his product may suddenly rise either due to the outbreak of war or as a result of the closing down of some of the other firms for some time on account of labor trouble. He therefore earns higher profit, which is like a windfall. We may conclude that an economist's profit is quite distinct from a businessman's profit. The former is concerned with net profit, which is arrived at by deducting from the businessman's gross profit the remuneration for the latter's own land, labor, and capital. We may write in equation form, gross profit equals net profit plus implicit rent plus implicit interest plus implicit wages plus depreciation and insurance charges. Net profit equals gross profit minus, in brackets, implicit rent plus implicit interest plus implicit wages plus depreciation and insurance charges, close brackets. Page number 631. Lesson number 2, Nature of Profit. The nature of profit has ever been the most perplexed and troubled problem for economists. Professor Taussig referred to it as that mixed and vexed income. The early classical economists regarded profit as accruing to the capitalist who supplied capital and owned the business. Profits were residually determined after making all necessary payments from the total income of the business. The first systematic explanation of the nature of profit was given by Marshall in terms of demand and supply of entrepreneurs. Walker looked upon profit as the reward of the entrepreneur with a superior ability than others. Hawley ascribed it to the entrepreneur's risk-taking. The greater the risk undertaken, the larger the profit. To Clark, Knight, and Schumpeter, it is an income which arises out of change, uncertainty, and friction inherent in a dynamic world and which the belated operation of competitive forces tends to eliminate. Veblen and Hobson, the Marxian economists, regard profit as unearned income and attribute it to the existence of institutional monopolies established by a few capitalists. Monopoly profits arise because a monopolist is able to restrict output and keep the price of his product much above the average cost of production. We discuss below some of the important theories of profit for understanding the nature of profit in detail. Lesson number 3, Theories of Profit. A. The Dynamic Theory. Professor J.B. Clark propounded his dynamic theory of profit in 1900. To him, profit is the difference between the price and the cost of production of the commodity. But profit is the result of dynamic change. In a dynamic state, 5 generic changes are going on, every one of which reacts on the structure of society. They are 1. population is increasing. 2. Capital is increasing. 3. Methods of production are improving. 4. The forms of industrial establishment are changing, the less efficient shops, etc. 4. The forms of industrial establishments are changing. The less efficient shops, etc., are passing from the field, and the more efficient and the most efficient are surviving. 5. The wants of consumers are multiplying. In a static state, competition tends to eliminate these 5 kinds of changes so that each factor receives what it produces. The selling price and the cost of production are equal and there are no profits. What entrepreneurs receive are simply wages of management. The static state is the state of natural adjustments between natural and actual prices of goods, wages, interest, profits, and their rates. In reality, both prices and rates are static. If there is any divergence between the two, competition tends to bring their equality. Thus, profits are the result exclusively of 5 dynamic changes, that is, changes in population, capital, techniques of production, forms of business organization, and in the wants of people. Obviously, from all the changes, according to Clark, 2 general results must follow. First, values, wages, and interest will differ from the static standards. Secondly, the static standards themselves will always be changing. Page number 632. The typical dynamic change is an invention. An invention enables the entrepreneur to produce more and reduce costs. A divergence between the selling price and the cost of production leads to the emergence of profits. But such profits are temporary because competition leads to the adoption of this invention by the other entrepreneurs in the industry. Production increases and prices fall. On the other hand, competition for the services of factors tends to raise their wages and interest rates. Costs rise. The dual tendency of falling prices and rising costs eliminates profits. Thus, profit is an elusive sum which entrepreneurs grasp but cannot hold. It slips through their fingers and bestows itself on all members of society. In the dynamic state, if competition worked without let or hindrance, pure business profit would be annihilated as fast as it could be created. In actuality, however, entrepreneurs earn profits because society, being dynamic, changes constantly occur and adjustments always take place. The lure of profits leads to improvement, and improvement tends to raise the standard of wages, but actual wages always lag behind the standard rate, with the result that profits appear. Its criticisms. J.B. Clark's dynamic theory of profit has been severely criticized, mainly by Professor F.H. Knight, on the following counts. 1. All changes not foreseen. It fails to make any difference between a change that is foreseen and one that is unforeseen in advance. If the 5 generic changes assumed by Clark are assumed to be foreknown in advance, so that their course may be correctly predicted, then the whole argument based on the effects of changes will not hold at all. In reality, however, not all changes are foreseen. Some are foreseen and some are not. For a clear understanding of the problem, it is essential to separate its effects from those of change as such. 2. Natural conditions, not static conditions. Professor Knight questions the use of natural prices and rates in a dynamic society. According to him, a society may be dynamic and yet all its natural prices might equal costs of production, so that the entrepreneur is not in a position to earn any profit. It is therefore fallacious for Clark to define natural conditions as static conditions. 3. Unpredictable changes lead to profits. Clark's argument that it is the lure of profit that leads to improvement is based on the foreknowledge of change. But when one's speculative element of making inventions and discovering new natural resources is removed, profits disappear and what remains are simply wages, interest and rent. This is so because all improvements are foreseen. Dynamic changes, according to Professor Knight, give rise to profits only when such changes and their consequences are unpredictable in character. 4. Profits without dynamic changes. Profits may also emerge in the absence of Clark's 5 dynamic changes. If future fluctuations are unpredictable, competition will not work itself accurately and profits will inevitably emerge. 5. Profit, the reward for risk-taking. Professor Clark makes no mention of the fact that profit is the reward of risk-taking. Page number 633. But in an article entitled Insurance and Profits, he points out that profit as the reward for risk-taking accrues to the capitalist and not to the entrepreneur. But he fails to point out what relation will profit bear to interest when profit accrues to the capitalist. In fact, profit accrues to the entrepreneur. 6. Superfluous distinction between profit and wages of management. Professor Tausig points out that Clark's dynamic theory creates an artificial distinction between profit and wages of management. According to Clark, even the routine work of an established industry requires the same judgment and administrative ability as is exercised by the entrepreneur under conditions of rapid progress. The entrepreneurs get wages of management because there are no risks in a static state. But this is not a correct view, for some unforeseen risks do remain even in a static state, for which a reward must be paid to the entrepreneur in the form of profit. Thus, the dynamic theory makes a superfluous distinction between profit and wages of management. 7. Profit, a frictional surplus. According to Professor A. K. Dasgupta, Clark's notion of economic dynamics is in fact one of comparative statics. The emergence of profit is considered to be merely a stage in the regular progress of the economy. In the ultimate analysis, it turns out to be a frictional surplus, the significance of which is just to raise the economic standard. B. The innovation theory. Professor Schumpeter attributes profits to dynamic changes resulting from an innovation. To start with, he takes a capitalist closed economy which is in a stationary equilibrium. This equilibrium is characterized by what Schumpeter calls a circular flow which continues to repeat itself forever. In such a static state, there is perfectly competitive equilibrium. The price of each product just equals its cost of production and there is no profit. Only exogenous factors like weather conditions can cause changes in the circular flow, but that too temporarily, and the economy would again reach a circular flow position. In the circular flow position, goods are being produced at a constant rate. This routine work is being performed by the salaried managers. It is the entrepreneur who disturbs the channels of this circular flow by the introduction of an innovation. Thus, Schumpeter assigns the role of an innovator not to the capitalist but to the entrepreneur. The entrepreneur is not a man of ordinary managerial ability but one who introduces something entirely new. He does not provide funds but directs their use. To perform his economic function, he requires two things. First, the existence of technical knowledge in order to produce new products. And second, the power of disposal over the factors of production in the form of credit. He gets credit from the banks and uses his ability to untap the existing technical knowledge. This brings about an innovation which disturbs the circular flow of production in the economy and leads to the emergence of profits. Thus, the role of the entrepreneur is quite distinct from that of a capitalist. Page number 634. The former simply innovates and does not undertake any risk. Risk-taking is the function of the capitalist or the banks that provide credit. Even if the entrepreneur is the capitalist himself, he performs two functions which are quite different. Profits, therefore, accrue to the entrepreneur as a reward for innovating and not as a reward for risk-taking. According to Schumpeter, an innovation may consist of 1. The introduction of a new product, 2. The introduction of a new method of production, 3. The opening up of a new market, 4. The discovery of a new source of raw materials, and 5. The recognition of an and 5. The reorganization of an industry. When any one of these innovations is introduced by an entrepreneur, it tends to reduce the cost of production of the commodity below its selling price. Profits emerge. So long as this particular innovation remains a secret, the entrepreneur continues to earn profits. But this state of affairs cannot continue indefinitely. Other entrepreneurs follow this innovation in swarm-like clusters. Competition for factor services tends to raise the cost of production, whereas increase in production brings prices downward. This dual tendency ultimately leads to the disappearance of profits. The emergence of profits due to an innovation is not peculiar to only one industry. Innovation in one field may induce other innovations in related fields. The emergence of a motor car industry may in turn stimulate a wave of new investments in the construction of highways, rubber tires, and petroleum products, etc. Profits are both the cause and the effect of innovations. The lure of profits leads entrepreneurs to innovate, and when an entrepreneur innovates, profits emerge. Profits continue to arise and disappear now in one industry and then in another. They are a temporary phenomena which accrue to the entrepreneur who innovates. But after some time, when it becomes common, profits disappear. Its criticisms. Schumpeter's innovation theory has been subjected to the following criticisms. 1. Shareholders earn profits. Schumpeter does not regard profits as the reward for risk-taking. According to him, risk-taking is the function of the capitalist and not of the entrepreneur as such. But in his later book, Capitalism, Socialism and Democracy, he points out that the rapid economic development of the 19th century in capitalist economies was partly due to many innovations made by the entrepreneurs who also happened to be risk takers. It is the shareholders of modern corporations who undertake risks and thus earn profits. 2. Profit, the reward for uncertainty. The element of uncertainty finds no place in Schumpeter's innovation theory. Profit is not regarded as a reward of uncertainty, which is not a correct view, for every innovation is associated with uncertainty. If innovation takes place without the element of uncertainty, the reward for innovation is not profit, but simply wages of management. 3. Incomplete explanation. Innovation is not the only function of the entrepreneur for which he earns profit. Profit accrues to the entrepreneur because of his organizational ability when he is able to reduce business costs. Thus, Schumpeter's theory is an incomplete explanation of the emergence of profits. Page number 635. C. The risk theory. The risk theory of profit is associated with F.B. Hawley, who regards risk-taking as the main function of the entrepreneur. Profit is the residual income which the entrepreneur receives because he assumes risks. the entrepreneur exposes his business to risk and receives in turn a reward in the form of profit because the task of risk-taking is irksome. Profit is an excess of payment above the actuarial value of the risk. No entrepreneur will be willing to undertake risks if he gets only the normal return. Therefore, the reward for risk-taking must be higher than the actual value of the risk. According to Hawley, the entrepreneur can avoid certain risks for a fixed payment to the insurance company. But he cannot get rid of all the risks by means of insurance, for if he is able to do so, he would cease to be an entrepreneur and would earn only wages of management and no profit. However, when the entrepreneur transfers his risks to the insurance company, he abdicates his risk-taking function to the latter, which receives the profit. The reward of the insurance company is not the premium it receives, but the difference between that premium and the loss it eventually suffers. So, profit is the reward of risk-taking, especially of wisely selected risks. But all persons are incapable of undertaking risks, so risks act as a deterrent to the supply of entrepreneurs. Those who remain in business are able to earn an excess of payment above the actuarial value of the risk and thus earn profits. Its criticisms. Like other theories, the risk theory of profit has also been criticized for the following reasons. 1. Meaning of risk unclear. Hawley does not clarify the meaning of risk. According to Knight, risks are of two types, insurable and non-insurable. Risks proper refer to insurable risks. Such risk-taking cannot give rise to profit because the entrepreneur covers the risk by the payment of the premium. He does not agree with Hawley that by insuring risk, the entrepreneur abdicates his function to the insurance company, which earns profit instead. Profit accrues to the entrepreneur and not to the insurer. It is only the uninsurable risks which are uncertain that give rise to profits. Profits are thus a reward of uncertainty bearing, according to Professor Knight. 2. Profits due to the entrepreneurial ability. Risk-taking is not the only entrepreneurial function which leads to the emergence of profits. Profits are also due to the organizational and coordinating ability of the entrepreneurs. This function leads to the reduction in business costs. It is also partly a reward for innovating. 3. Profits, the reward of avoiding risks. According to Carver, those entrepreneurs who are able to avoid risks earn profits. Page number 636. Hence, profits arise not because risks are undertaken, but because they are avoided by able entrepreneurs. The more risks are avoided, the larger will be the profits earned by the entrepreneurs. 4. Amount of profit not related to size of risk. The quantum of profit in any way is not related to the size of the risk undertaken. If it were so, every entrepreneur would involve himself into huge risks in order to earn larger profits. 5. Incomplete theory. There is little empirical evidence to prove that entrepreneurs earn more in risky enterprises. In a way, all enterprises are risky, for an element of uncertainty is present in them. And every entrepreneur aims at making larger profits. Thus, Hawley's risk theory is also an incomplete theory of profit. D. The uncertainty-bearing theory. Professor Frank H. Knight regards profit as the reward of bearing non-insurable risks and uncertainties. He distinguishes between insurable and non-insurable risks. Certain risks are measurable inasmuch as the probability of their occurrence can be statistically calculated. The risk of fire, theft of merchandise, and of death by accident are insurable. Such risks are borne by the insurance company. There are certain unique risks which are incalculable. The probability of their occurrence cannot be statistically computed because of the presence of uncertainty in them. Such unforeseen risks related to changes in prices, demand, supply, etc. No insurance company can calculate the loss expected from such risks, and hence they are non-insurable. Profit, according to Knight, is the reward of bearing non-insurable risks and uncertainties. It is a deviation arising from uncertainty between earning ex post and ex ante. Profit is thus the difference between ex ante and ex post returns. It is the residue after deducting all contractual income to the other factor services. In a competitive economy, if entrepreneurs compete cautiously and do not raise prices of factor services to the value of their marginal product, they will earn positive profits. If, on the other hand, they are optimist about future expectations, profits will be negative because the factor services are paid more than their anticipated marginal products. Positive or negative profits simply reflect the entrepreneur's judgment to meet conditions of uncertainty. However, uncertainty prevails the entire society, and profit, positive or negative, in a way accrues to all factor services. In other words, there is profit element in all types of income. But the division of social income between profit and contractual income depends on the supply of entrepreneurial ability. When the supply of entrepreneurial ability is small, the size of profit increases. The supply of entrepreneurial ability is subject to diminishing returns, which tends to reduce the size of profit. The application of diminishing returns to entrepreneurship is nothing except the amount of uncertainty present in business. Uncertainty bearing is the most important function in a dynamic state. It is the entrepreneur who either delegates this function among different personnel or assumes it himself. The expectation of profit is, in a way, the supply price of entrepreneurial uncertainty bearing. In a competitive economy, where there is no risk, every entrepreneur will have a minimum supply price. Page number 637. If his reward falls below it, the entrepreneurial services will not be supplied. But the presence of uncertainty tends to raise the minimum supply price, which is actually a risk premium which the entrepreneur expects to be paid. This is profit. But change due to innovations and exogenous forces such as climatic and other unforeseen changes are constantly causing revision of these expectations, so that the entrepreneur receives only normal profit in the long run. Only unpredictable changes give rise to profit. Changes in population and capital, being predictable, do not occasion imperfect competition or profit. Thus, profit is due to non-insurable risks and uncertainties generated by dynamic changes. Its criticisms. Knight's theory of profit is more elaborate than the other theories because it combines the conceptions of risk, of economic change, and of the role of business ability. But it has its weaknesses. 1. No clear notion of entrepreneurship. It does not include a clear notion of entrepreneurship. His sole function is regarded as one of the uncertainty bearing. But in modern business corporations, ownership is separate from control. Decision making is done by the salaried managers who control and organize the entire corporation, whereas ownership rests with shareholders who ultimately bear uncertainties of business. Knight does not separate the two, and his theory becomes unrealistic. 2. No solution to distribution of profit among holders of corporations. As a corollary, the theory does not solve the problem of allocation or distribution of profit among the controlling and ownership groups of the corporation, and thus keeps the problem of the determination of profit unsolved. 3. No empirical evidence to measure uncertainty bearing. Knight himself finds little empirical evidence to measure uncertainty bearing to arrive at the quantum of profit accruing to a firm. Thus, uncertainty bearing explains the emergence of profit in a vague manner. 4. Changes in population and capital unpredictable. Knight's assertion that changes in population and capital are predictable is true only if we are dealing with the economy as a whole. But his study of profit is related to a business firm for which changes in population and capital are unpredictable. And in terms of Knight's theory, they can also lead to positive or negative profit. 5. Profit not a residual income. Knight's view that profit is a residual income which accrues to the entrepreneur on the basis of his judgment has also been criticized. According to J.F. Weston, the ultimate decision makers in a firm need not be compensated as residual income receivers. Judgment is an economic service. The principles explaining the compensation for this service are similar to the principles explaining the compensation for other services. The exercise of judgment may be sold on a fixed price basis or on a variable price basis. This is how the expert managers sell their services. Page number 638. Uncertainty bearing not a separate factor of production. Uncertainty bearing cannot be looked upon as a separate factor of production like land, labor, or capital. It is a psychological concept which forms part of the real cost of production. But the supply of a factor service, much less of entrepreneurial ability, depends on its opportunity cost rather than on real cost. 7. Does not study monopoly profit. This theory throws no light on monopoly profit. Monopoly firms earn much larger profits than competitive firms, and they are not due to the presence of uncertainty. Despite these weaknesses, the uncertainty bearing theory of Knight is regarded as the only satisfactory explanation of the nature of profit. E. Shackle's theory. Professor G. L. S. Shackle has extended Knight's theory of profit by introducing expectations under conditions of uncertainty. According to Shackle, expectations are of two types, general and particular. General expectations relate to variables general to the economy as a whole. They are associated with future macro variables such as the general price level, GNP, balance of payments, etc. On the other hand, particular expectations relate to variables particular to a firm or industry. They are associated with such micro variables as the future reaction of a particular marketing strategy adopted by a firm, the future pricing policy of a competitive firm, etc. The decisions of the business community are generally based on general expectations. If it regards them favorable, investments are made. But there is subjective certainty in the case of general expectations. Their time horizon is about 12 months. As the general expectations have subjective certainty and their time horizon is also of reasonable duration, the business community is able to anticipate price and income price. The business community is able to anticipate price and income increases correctly for the economy as a whole, and by adopting appropriate inventory policies, it earns windfall profits. But in the case of particular expectations, there is subjective uncertainty and the time horizon is also quite long, ranging between 100 to 150 months. Under particular expectations, a firm or an industry may earn either innovative profits or monopoly profits depending upon its policies and competitors. Under perfect competitions, the number of buyers and sellers of a similar product is very large. A firm which innovates in introducing new techniques of production or new products or new techniques of management earns innovators' profits. On the other hand, when there is monopolistic competition and the product is differentiated, it is the marketing policy that leads to profits. As there is subjective uncertainty and the time horizon is quite long, it is the taking of correct decisions by a firm about marketing, advertising, etc. of its products in relation to the products of its competitors that lead to monopoly profits. Thus, profits, whether monopoly or innovative, arise under subjective uncertainty depending upon correct decision making by a firm. Who takes such decisions in a firm and what is the basis? According to Shackle, decision making under uncertainty is done by the entrepreneur of a firm. The routine types of decisions which often require weighing the evidence are made by the respective heads of departments in the firm. Page number 639. So far as the basis of decision making is concerned, Shackle adopts a psychological approach. According to him, the entrepreneur formulates hypotheses about the future consequences of his decision. He imagines a neutral point to the right of which he places those hypotheses that are pleasing and to the left of it those that are displeasing. All pleasing or displeasing consequences that are close to the neutral point appear very plausible and have a low degree of potential surprise. But more pleasing and more displeasing hypotheses that are moving away from the neutral point on both directions have a growing degree of potential surprise. To take one hypothesis, it is a combination of its plausibility and its relative pleasantness and unpleasantness. When the entrepreneur moves towards the right of the neutral point, the hypothesis grows in pleasantness faster than it grows in implausibility. But after a point, the increasing pleasantness offsets the increasing implausibility of the hypothesis. Ultimately, there is peak hypothesis on the pleasant side. On the other hand, when the entrepreneur moves towards the left of the neutral point, the hypothesis grows in pleasantness faster than it grows in plausibility. But after a certain point, the increasing unpleasantness offsets the increasing plausibility of the hypothesis. Ultimately, there will also be a peak hypothesis on the unpleasant side. Shackle calls the pleasant side peak the focus gain and unpleasant side peak the focus loss. If the focus gain exceeds the focus loss, the entrepreneur will make a positive decision. He will make investments and earn profits. On the contrary, if the focus loss exceeds the focus gain, the entrepreneur will make a negative decision and refrain from making investments because his particular expectations are likely to be unfavorable. Thus, in Shackle's theory, the entrepreneurial decision making is neither irrational nor whimsical. Rather, it is based on his intuitive perception. Its criticisms. Professor Shackle has formulated a psychological theory of profits which is highly abstract. But it contains within it the elements of Knight's uncertainty theory of profits, Schumpeter's innovations theory of profits, and monopoly theory of profits. However, it is essentially a decision theory which is based on the psychology of the entrepreneur. As pointed out by Professor Kierstedt, Professor Shackle himself uses the device of introspection effectively, but introspection can allow him to discover how he makes a decision. It cannot tell with any certainty how an entrepreneur or a board of directors makes a decision. F. The marginal productivity theory of profit. The determination of the remuneration of the entrepreneur, like any other factor, is sought to be explained in terms of its marginal revenue productivity. Edgeworth, Chapman, Stiegler, and recently Stonier and Haag have explained the determination of profit with the help of this theory. Page number 640. According to this theory, profits as the reward of an entrepreneur is determined by its marginal revenue productivity. The higher the marginal revenue productivity, the higher are the profits, and the lower the marginal revenue productivity, the lower are the profits of an entrepreneur. Its criticisms. The marginal productivity theory of profit is not free from criticisms. First, as noted above, like land, labor or capital, the marginal revenue productivity of entrepreneurship is a meaningless concept in the case of a firm because, unlike other factors, there can be only one entrepreneur in a firm. Secondly, the theory is based on the unrealistic assumption of the homogeneity of entrepreneurs in an industry. Entrepreneurs differ in efficiency. It is therefore not possible to have one marginal revenue productivity curve for all entrepreneurs. The theory thus fails to determine profit accurately. Thirdly, as a corollary, since entrepreneurs differ in efficiency, all cannot earn only normal profits. Entrepreneurs with greater efficiency than others would be earning more than normal profits. This will be the rent of ability which will be included in the profits earned by them. This theory throws no light on this aspect. Fourth, the theory fails to explain why entrepreneurs sometimes earned windfalls or chance gains and even monopoly profits. Fifthly, it is essentially a static theory according to which all entrepreneurs earn only normal profits in the long run. The real world is, however, dynamic, in which some entrepreneurs earn more than normal profits. Sixthly, it is a one-sided theory which takes into account only the demand for entrepreneurs and neglects the supply of entrepreneurs. G. Rent theory of profit. The rent theory of profit was developed by an American economist, Francis L. Walker. Walker maintains that profit is the rent of ability. Like different grades of land, entrepreneurs are also of different abilities. Entrepreneurs of superior ability earn profits just as superior lands earn rent. According to Walker, just as there is the marginal or no rent land, similarly there exists a marginal or no profit entrepreneur who earns only wages of management. The marginal or no profit entrepreneur is the least efficient one, earning profit not beyond an amount just sufficient to keep him in the present industry. The industry managed by the marginal entrepreneur is similar to the marginal land. Just as land at the margin is no rent land, similarly, the marginal entrepreneur earns no profit. But there are other industries under the control of entrepreneurs possessing superior abilities which yield profits. The entrepreneur with superior ability earns profit as the reward over the ability of the marginal or no profit entrepreneur. The marginal entrepreneur sells his product at its cost price and earns no profit. Thus, profit does not enter into the cost of production of the marginal entrepreneur. Since price equals cost of production, profit, like rent, does not enter into price. Page number 641. Since price equals cost of production, profit, like rent, does not enter into price. Thus, the essential nature of profit does not differ from that of rent. Just as rent is a differential surplus accruing to the superior land over the marginal or no rent land, Similarly, profit is a differential surplus which accrues to the superior ability entrepreneur over the marginal or no-profit entrepreneur. Its criticisms. The rent theory of profits has been criticized on the following points. 1. Not a true surplus. According to Marshall, profits do not constitute a true surplus. All pieces of land earn positive or zero rent. On no piece of land, rent can be negative. But in the case of firms, sometimes entrepreneurs may have negative profits or losses. 2. Not a realistic theory. In the modern times, the distribution of dividends among shareholders does not have anything to do with the superior ability of entrepreneurs. As a result, Walker's notion of profit as a surplus, like rent, is unrealistic. 3. Profit arises in a dynamic state. Another dissimilarity between rent and profits is concerned with their status in the dynamic and static states. Rent can emerge in both static and dynamic conditions, whereas profits can be found only in a dynamic society. 4. Profits and price. According to the rent theory, profits are a residue and therefore do not enter into prices. If profits are a residue, then they cannot constitute a part of the cost of production. But this is unrealistic because normal profits are an integral part of the cost of production and enter into price. 5. Profit not due to ability. Profit does not arise always due to the superior ability of the entrepreneur. It may arise due to monopoly, innovation, risk, uncertainty, etc. 6. No profit entrepreneur, not a reality. Walker's notion of a no profit or marginal entrepreneur is not a reality. If an entrepreneur is not earning profit and only wages of management, he is just like the manager of a firm. He may shut his firm and do something else. H. The theory of profit. The wage theory of profit was put forward by Professor Taussig of America in the late 19th century. According to him, profits are best regarded as simply a form of wages. They accrue to the entrepreneur on account of his special ability. He finds a close similarity between a laborer and an entrepreneur. Just as a laborer receives wages for his services, so does an entrepreneur receive profits for his services. The entrepreneur performs mental labor like teachers, lawyers, doctors, etc. But the only difference between the entrepreneur and other mental workers is that the entrepreneur receives profit for his special ability. It is a surplus after meeting all expenses of production, whereas the wage forms a part of the cost of production. Its criticisms. This theory has been criticized for equating the functions of an entrepreneur with that of the worker for the following reasons. Page number 642. 1. Element of risk and uncertainty. The entrepreneur's work involves risk and uncertainty of business, and profit is the reward for undertaking these. But the worker receives wages simply for his labor. He does not bear any risk and uncertainty relating to his work except losing his job. 2. Profits not certain. A worker must get his wages so long as he works. But the profits of an entrepreneur are not certain. He may not receive any profit for his mental ability. 3. Profits vary. Profits may rise or fall depending upon economic conditions. But wages may remain stable during the short period. They have also a tendency to increase over the long run. 4. Silent about shareholders. The shareholders do not perform any function in a company, but they receive the share of profits in the form of dividend for undertaking risk of money invested in the company. This theory fails to explain this phenomenon. 5. Windfall profits. The entrepreneur may receive windfall or chance profits, but a worker does not get chance wages. Thus, the wage theory of profits is unsatisfactory. I. Determination of profits under perfect competition or modern theory. Profits, like the reward of any other factor service, are determined by the forces of demand and supply. This theory defines the entrepreneur as a business enterprise itself and profits as his net income. Profits as the reward of an entrepreneur are governed by the demand for and supply of entrepreneurs. Demand for entrepreneurs. The demand for entrepreneurs depends upon the A. the level of industrial development in the economy, B. the element of uncertainty in the industry, C. the scale of production, and D. the marginal revenue productivity of entrepreneurship. If the level of industrial progress is high, the scale of production is large, and efficiency and productivity increase, profits tend to be high and the demand for entrepreneurs rises in the economy. Similarly, if the element of uncertainty is high in the economy, there will be greater chances of earning high profits and the demand for entrepreneurs will also rise. But the marginal revenue productivity of entrepreneurship is the most important factor in influencing the demand for entrepreneurs. In the case of land, labor, or capital, it is possible to calculate the marginal revenue productivity of any one factor to a firm. The theory of marginal revenue productivity presupposes that the firm can demand even the smallest unit of a factor. But this is impossible with regard to the entrepreneur, who is a fixed and indivisible factor. A firm can have only one entrepreneur. Or, at best, it can have more than one person sharing the entrepreneurial functions of management, uncertainty bearing, etc. This procedure may reduce costs, increase output, but in no way increase the quantity of entrepreneurs in a firm. Moreover, there is no yardstick to measure the amount of entrepreneurship either by the time involved in making a decision by the entrepreneur or in terms of physical units. Page number 643. It is therefore not possible to calculate the marginal revenue productivity of entrepreneurship to a firm. However, it is not difficult to measure the marginal revenue productivity of entrepreneurship to an industry. In an industry, the amount of entrepreneurs varies with the changes in the number of firms. The marginal revenue productivity curve of entrepreneurs is downward sloping like the ordinary demand curve. It is therefore the demand curve of entrepreneurs. As the number of entrepreneurs increases in an industry, profit made by each will diminish. This is realistic because with the increase in the number of firms, output increases, prices fall, which lead to the diminution of profit. Supply of entrepreneurs. The supply of entrepreneurs depends upon a number of factors. They are A. the availability of capital, B. the existence of managerial and technical personnel, C. the size of population, D. the number of entrepreneurs, E. the element of uncertainty in the industry, F. the distribution of income, G. the industrial experience, and H. the condition of society. Entrepreneurship is always attracted by the supply of capital because no business can be started without it. Other things being equal, the larger the availability of capital, the larger is the supply of entrepreneurs. Capital may be available in sufficient amount, but an entrepreneur has to depend largely on managers and other technical personnel for running the business successfully. If trained managerial and other personnel are available, the supply of entrepreneurs is bound to increase. The size of population is another factor that influences entrepreneurship. The larger the size of population, the higher will be the demand for various products, which will attract more people to entrepreneurship, and the supply of entrepreneurs will increase. If the number of entrepreneurs is already large in an industry, profits may be low and the supply of entrepreneurs to this particular industry may be retarded for some time. However, in the long run, the supply of entrepreneurs may increase for the economy as a whole when the sons and relatives of successful entrepreneurs also enter as entrepreneurs in the same or in some new venture. This may be due to imbibing industrial experience through heredity or otherwise working under efficient entrepreneurs. If the uncertainty element is high in the economy, profit expectations will also be high and the supply of entrepreneurs is large. On the contrary, if people are very cautious and fear to undertake uncertainties and risks, the supply of entrepreneurs will be low because of the low profit expectations. If there is unequal distribution of income in society, the supply of entrepreneurs will be large because the existing entrepreneurs are already earning supernormal profits. On the other hand, in case of somewhat equal distribution of income, the entrepreneurs will not be earning high profits and their supply will be less. The condition of society is the most important determinant of the supply of entrepreneurs because it encompasses all factors enumerated above. Page number 644. It also includes political stability, economic conditions, and legal framework in the society. For an increasing supply of entrepreneurs, there must be political stability. Rapid economic fluctuations mar business confidence and expectations and discourage the supply of entrepreneurs. Therefore, economic conditions should also be stable. Similarly, stringent laws in relation to business houses, high corporation taxes, etc., retard the supply of entrepreneurs, while a helping attitude in the form of low taxes, credit facilities, etc., encourages the supply of entrepreneurs. In all these causes discussed above, we find that the supply of entrepreneurs will increase with higher profits and decrease with lower profits. Thus, the shape of the supply curve of entrepreneurship will be positively inclined from left to right upward like an ordinary supply curve SE as shown in figure 51.1. Since we are assuming perfect competition, all entrepreneurs in an industry being homogeneous and of equal efficiency, the supply of entrepreneurship is infinitely elastic to the industry in the long run. Every entrepreneur will be earning only normal profits equal to his transfer earnings. It further implies transfer earnings are the same in all industries. In case an entrepreneur is not in a position to earn the minimum transfer earnings in this industry, he will move to some other industry to earn normal profits there. Thus, the supply curve entrepreneurship will be a horizontal straight line parallel to the x-axis as shown in figure 51.2 as the PS curve. In the short run, it can be upward sloping like the SE curve in figure 51.1, and entrepreneurs can earn more than their minimum supply price over their transfer earnings OS in the form of supernormal profits. Its determination. The determination of profit is explained with the aid of figure 51.2. MRP is the marginal revenue productivity curve of entrepreneurship and PS is the supply curve of entrepreneurship. The number of entrepreneurs is taken along the horizontal axis and the amount of profits on the vertical axis. Assuming freedom of entry and exit of firms in the industry, equilibrium is reached when OE entrepreneurs are earning OP profits. Page number 645. OP is the level of normal profits which all entrepreneurs earn in the long run. It implies that all entrepreneurs, being homogeneous and of equal ability, earn OP profits equal to their transfer earnings. In the short run, entrepreneurs can earn supernormal profits. Since entry into the industry is not possible, in the short run, OE1 entrepreneurs might be earning PP1 supernormal profits. But in the long run, supernormal profits would be competed away and entrepreneurs can earn only normal profits, OP. OP thus represents transfer earnings to this industry, for all the entrepreneurs can earn this much in some other industry. They will stay in this industry only if they continue to get at least OP profits. Assuming imperfect competition in the industry, entrepreneurs can earn supernormal profits in the long term because there is no free entry into the industry and supernormal profits are not competed away. In terms of Knight's theory, if profit is regarded as the reward for bearing non-insurable risks and uncertainties, then under perfect competition there can be no profit in the long run. It is a static state here. Population, capital, technology, taste, business organization and incomes do not change. Even if they change, they are predictable. Thus, there is no risk and uncertainty. The marginal revenue productivity curve of entrepreneurship would be zero. Hence, profits would also be zero. However, even in a static state, profits exist because profits are not competed away due to the presence of imperfect competition. So, what entrepreneurs earn are monopoly profits rather than pure profits. Manager entrepreneurs earn wages of management and capitalist entrepreneurs earn interest. Entrepreneurs earn supernormal profits in the long run because the present-day world is dynamic and changing, uncertainty prevails in the production and sale of products and competition is seldom perfect. Lesson number 4. Surplus and normal profits. Normal profits are the wages of management which an entrepreneur receives. They form part of the cost of production of a firm. On the other hand, surplus or abnormal or supernormal profits are those profits which an entrepreneur gets above normal profits. Marshall defined normal profits as the supply price of average business ability and energy. It is a fair or normal rate of profits that must exist in order to attract men of adequate business ability to any industry. It is a reward which an entrepreneur expects to receive in the long run when the industry is in equilibrium so that it enters into the cost of production. Modern economists have interpreted it in the terms of transfer earning. Assuming all entrepreneurs to be of equal efficiency, they must earn normal profits in order to stay in the industry. Normal profits are thus transfer earnings to this industry, which entrepreneurs must earn at least, otherwise they will go to the other industry. Stonier and Haag define normal profits, which are just sufficient to induce an entrepreneur to stay in the industry. This definition implies that profits of all entrepreneurs in any industry must equal in the long run. If an industry is earning supernormal profits, new firms will be attracted to it and supernormal profits will be competed away. Page number 646. On the contrary, if firms in an industry are incurring losses, some of them will leave the industry, supply will fall, price will rise, and the firms will start earning normal profits. Mrs. Joanne Robinson, therefore, defines normal profits as that level of profit at which there is no tendency for new firms to enter the trade or for old firms to disappear out of it. According to Professor Knight, the concept of normal profits is related to the equilibrium state in which all changes and risks can be calculated and anticipated. in the equilibrium state, there is no incentive for firms to leave or enter the industry. All resources are fully employed. There is no uncertainty. Pure profits would tend to disappear and all entrepreneurs would earn only wages of management. The wages of management are, in fact, normal profits. Surplus or abnormal profits may arise in a dynamic state in the short run when some efficient entrepreneurs earn more than normal profits even when no uncertainty is present. However, the possibility of earning abnormal profits in the long run is not ruled out altogether. In the presence of uncertainty and change, under perfect competition, entrepreneurs are able to earn more than normal profits. Under monopoly, abnormal profits tend to be permanent. When the product has no substitute, its demand is rigid and uncertainty is present. Lesson number 5. Monopoly profits. Under monopoly, profits emerge because the monopolist possesses the power to regulate the supply or price of his product. Besides, there are other reasons for the production of an article. The monopoly firm may possess the patent right on the exclusive production of a commodity or use of a process. Or a firm may grow to such proportions that it tends to drive competitors out of the market. A firm may also earn monopoly profit because of its monopolistic position in the labor market in the absence of trade unions. However, innovations and uncertainties give rise to a surplus above normal profits, which are characterized as monopoly profits. When a firm innovates, it faces uncertainties. But when the innovation becomes successful, the firm earns monopoly profits. Once the innovation is patented, profits accruing to the firm are not monopoly profits in the true sense of the term. If the firm sells the process to other firms, what it receives is the economic rent. This rent aspect of monopoly profits appears when uncertainties connected with the innovation disappear. According to Professor Schumpeter, monopoly profits also arise when the entrepreneur has no competitors as the new product first appears. The determination of its price is according to the principle of monopoly price. Professor Knight attributes monopoly profits to the presence of uncertainty in business. In industries where uncertainty is the greatest, entrepreneurs who successfully bear uncertainties earn more than normal profits. This surplus results from failure on the part of other entrepreneurs to estimate the situation correctly. As a result, the successful entrepreneurs procure the means of production at cheaper rates than others and thus earn a surplus which may be called monopoly surplus. Thus, monopoly profits arise from monopolistic tendencies in pricing or from a process of dynamic change in the presence of uncertainties in which long-run equilibrium is not attained. Page number 647. Exercises. 1. Distinguish between net and gross profit. 2. Critically discuss Clark's dynamic theory of profits. 3. Discuss Schumpeter's innovation theory of profits. 4. Profit is the reward for uncertainty bearing. Discuss. 5. Explain the modern theory of profits. 6. Write notes on A. Surplus and normal profits. B. Monopoly profits. 7. Explain critically the rent theory of profits.